Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 100 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her motherhood. You heard me right. And before we start the episode, just know it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode and rate and review us because, well, guess what? I listen to these things. And I welcome your thoughts. Love to hear from you. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So I'm trolling along the New York Times, right? And I'm reading this fabulous piece that was written as an op-ed. It's about motherhood. And what is it? Is it a sacrifice to be a mother? Is it not? And I'm reading the entire article and I'm absolutely captivated. What the heck? It was such a wild and crazy twist that motherhood is a privilege, not a sacrifice. Say what? Well, we have the author with us, and the author just happens to be Karen Rinaldi, who turned out to be a wonderful friend from the publishing world, where I come from as well. And Karen currently is the publisher of Harper Wave, an imprint she founded in 2012, and she's also a senior vice president at HarperCollins Publishers. She's worked in the publishing industry for over two decades as a publisher, editor, and content creator. She wrote the story for the movie Maggie's Plan. What a great ending that was. The 2015 film inspired by her novel, The End of Men. Go out and read it. It's awesome. Her nonfiction work has appeared in the New York Times, Oprah.com, Time, Motto, among others. And she lives in New York City with her husband and two sons. And she wrote this amazing op-ed. Karen, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Pam. It's great to be here with you and great to be on the podcast.
Now, you're sitting there, you know, and you're talking to your mother in this op-ed, and there you are working around, and you've got your family, your husband, and two sons at that time, 9 and 7, and you want to spend time just on the shore, relaxing. Your mother asked what we'd be doing on vacation, and you said you'd be together, going to the beach, the nearby amusement park, cooking, playing in the yard, and in response, your mother said to you, "Oh, that's not much of a vacation for you. I'll bet you can't wait to get back to work. Motherhood, it's the hardest job in the world. All sacrifice." And your response was, "Really? What did you mean by that? What's going on here? I thought it was all sacrifice. What do you mean that motherhood is selfish?"
Well, I guess the selfish is a provocative term, and it's not selfishness in the pejorative, but rather something that we do. Motherhood is something we do with self-interest and not negative. So to say that it's selfish is putting a finer point on the opposite, which when people say, "Oh, motherhood, it's just selflessness." And I'm going, yeah, we've got skin in the game. These are people, these are beings that we put in the world and that we care for and enjoy and have the privilege to educate and help raise them into responsible, caring adults. And to me, it's a great, not only a great privilege to be able to do that, but also, you know, the selfishness is implied in the self-interest that we have in seeing our own children thrive and do well and become good people. So I just take issue with the language that we use when we talk about it. And I think that, you know, language can... language is important, right? We are the stories we tell, and by using the language of selflessness and martyrdom and sacrifice, you know, out the window goes a mother's agency, you know, and in comes something else. So that's how I truck with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, since we have to give up things for our children and all these, oh my goodness, how do you not see this as sacrifice? You know, I bet a bunch of women out there in her podcast land are going, say what, girlfriend?
Yeah,
what?
No, I
what
know.
What is she saying, man? I'm sacrificing my ass off here.
Yeah, you know what? And I got a lot of that response. Actually, I got a lot of both. I got a lot of responses from both sides who said, oh, yeah, you know, I agree. I see it that way. And people who said, what are you talking about? You know, it's all sacrifice. And I understand. I understand the people who take issue with it. So my answer to that is that I think, again, the way we talk about it is that, you know, having children, for those who choose to have children, there are, you know, let's just say right here, there are definitely those people for whom, you know, there isn't birth control available, who get pregnant and have children, get pregnant by mistake or something worse. There are a lot of situations. I am talking about women who choose to have, you know, children and do so with intention. And yet what I'm saying, I think, affects all motherhood in every situation, but more about that later. So the way I think about it is that, you know, when we gain something by making a choice, giving one thing up for another, instead of buying that nice, you know, pair of shoes, I have to, you know, buy my child the pair of shoes to get to school with, or buy, you know, going to get a manicure or a pedicure, or, you know, I am going to spend time with my child to help them with their homework. By saying I can't go on vacation because I have to, you know, buy my child school supplies, whatever it is, you're giving up one thing for another. Absolutely. Absolutely. But giving up one thing for another doesn't necessarily imply sacrifice, right? It means that you're not getting anything back. And to care for your children, to me, I go back to, is such a privilege and such a gift that flows in both directions, that to say that it's sacrifice basically sets a situation up where you're, again, martyred. And I also think, well, what message does that send your children, right? I've sacrificed everything for you, you ungrateful.
Oh, I've never heard that before.
Well, happens all the time, right? And you know what? How does that make that little person feel, that 4-year-old, that 6-year-old, that 8-year-old, that 10 or 12 or 17-year-old? All of a sudden you take away, you know, you need to respect your child, and your child will learn self-respect and therefore respect you back. As soon as you don't do that, you know, and it's all about you and me, and I've sacrificed this for you, what are you going to give me in return? Uh-oh, right there, it changes the dynamics completely. And I don't think a child deserves that. Make a child deserve
I love that.
Your full attention. And here's the thing. I think most parents, I do, I really believe in my soul that most parents feel the same way. I think it's in the language with which we talk about it is where it gets confused, which is what my piece was originally intended to challenge, which is, let's talk about the language we use, because language is important. The stories we tell ourselves and our children is important. And those stories become real, right? We are, you know, a lot of what makes us human is our ability to communicate and to speak and to have language and use language. It becomes who we are. And so I'm saying, let's pay attention to the way we talk about this. But yes, we do give up one thing. We give up things for other things in everything we do. We have choices in everything we do, but own those choices, have agency in those choices. And I believe that makes us more empowered, and I believe it makes our children more empowered.
You know, that's so interesting. You know, when I didn't tell you this when we had spoken, you know, at first mm-hmm. a while back about this, and I was getting you on board for this show. Mm-hmm. As I was reading through this and that thing about sacrifice and privilege, something was tickling in the back of my brain. All of a sudden, it just sort of emerged. And that was, as a physician, I have heard, again, that language, you know, the sacrifice you went through all those years of training and,
right.
you know, sweating it out and eating, you know, dead lettuce, you know, late at night.
Right, yeah.
Because that was about all you could, you know, scope up from the hospital, you know, cafeteria and all the rest of it. And you know what's really fascinating? is that I never saw it as a sacrifice, not for one second.
Right.
I saw it as an honor and a privilege when someone shared their life with me. You know, if someone was sitting in front of me and telling me, you know, whatever was going on personally, as it affected their mind and body, I just felt that. And to this moment, I feel this is the highest honor and privilege. I never once saw it as sacrifice. Yet other people would say that. Well, you didn't do this and that because you were, you know, all those years of training. Well, no, I was impassioned by what I'm doing.
Right.
When I see a good mother, when I listen to you talk about your children, Karen, you know, you literally just, you know, reek of passion for being a mother.
Yeah,
and
being
I'm getting the privilege
awesome.
Thing from you. Does that make sense, seriously?
Yeah, no, well, you just touched on something that I think that's really important, because you just, it's exactly what I'm getting to, is that we can talk about, you know, what's important is the, you know, our relationships, our family, our friends, our community is important. Our livelihood, what we do, whatever it is that we're doing, we want to do it well. In a job, you know, I have a job that, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I can't judge it, but it takes me, you know, into my evening hours. It takes me into the weekends. It takes me into vacations. I've worked vacations, evenings, and weekends my entire life. And again, as an editor and a publisher, it's a great privilege because I get to talk to incredible people like you and experts and writers and artists and, you know, statesmen and everything else. And I think, well, for that, what I have to do is my free time is really not my own free time. And it's just managing my time is something I wind up having to do. And you go, is that a sacrifice? Or is that a privilege? And again, it's about framing. It's only about framing it. So it could be job. It could be your family. You can use this language and apply it to the very important things in your life. Taking care of elderly parents. You know, that's hard. It's hard. You know, you do it. And many of us have to do it at some point, right? If you're lucky enough to have your parents, you know, survive into old age, is that a sacrifice or a privilege to take care of them? Again, it's framing, and I believe if we frame it in the positive and we frame it in that, then we can go into it. It helps us not feel bereft, not feel angry and bitter and frustrated that we're not doing something else, but instead it says, I'm going to surrender to this great responsibility that I'm in and try to learn and grow from it and appreciate it for what it is. So whether you're taking care of a patient, or answering a patient's call at night, or, you know, when they're panicked, or taking care of your children or your elderly parents. Again, it doesn't mean it's not hard. I think that's where a lot of the argument got hogtied, is that people are like, but it's hard. Say, yeah, it's hard. What do we do that's worthwhile isn't hard? Who says that things should be easy? I mean, where'd that come from? I don't know anything that's really worthwhile that's necessarily easy. You know, okay.
Oh, there's no question. All you have to do is read George Leonard's extraordinary, iconic book, Mastery, and understand that if you want to be able to master anything in life, excuse me, you got to put it out there. But the words, though, Karen, you know,
words.
When you keep going back to the vernacular, here's a piece from your op-ed. Calling motherhood a woman's job only serves to keep a woman in her place. The priorities of mothers who work outside the home are often questioned. It's as if women are forced to choose between ambition or simply earning a living wage and family. And, you know, then you, go earlier in your op-ed, you mentioned Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which, of course, now is playing on Netflix and is, you know, winning all kinds of awards. And you brought that up. Why did you bring up The Handmaid's Tale within the context of what you talked about in the op-ed?
Margaret Atwood created... She did an interview recently with Rebecca Mead for the New Yorker Radio Hour, and she was talking about how... I think Rebecca Mead asked her, and I'm going to paraphrase this, you know, how did you come up with this fiction, you know, this fictionalized, you know, st- story. And Margaret Atwood kind of replied, she goes, what do you mean? It's not really fiction. It's just a, you know, it's a version of reality. So the point is that women are always at risk. I really believe this. I think women are always at risk at having their, you know, their agency, their rights taken away from them. It took us a long time to get them to the extent that we have them. We still have a long way to go. There was the first wave. There was the second wave of feminism. There's the third one we're in the middle of now. You know, it's still a struggle. And Margaret Atwood's book, I thought, just exemplified it sort of just as brutally as possible, which is to say that there are women who are there to be wives, and there are women there to be procreate, and the powers that be will determine who is, you know, who is who, and whose job is to do what, and it's controlled, and of course, it's a dystopic, you know, horror novel, really. So what I say, what I'm saying is that when it comes to the motherhood, you know, motherhood is not a job. And I say in the piece that if it were a job, somebody would be employing her, right? And then somebody would be her boss. And, you know, what you hope is that there is, you know, there are single mothers, certainly. And again, the burden for single mothers is large, but I do think that there should be services to support single mothers more. But I think you get that by not being martyred, but by being fierce and strong and determined and having agency and saying, I deserve to have some help because what I'm doing contributes to the world at large, because it's important. And I'm not a martyr. So I'm not doing this to be, you know, I'm not doing this to be sacrificed for the world. You know, we're doing it in self-interest. And then you could say self-interest in the individual and self-interest in humanity. I mean, you could actually take that and extrapolate it into something larger. And again, the language is important because, you know, one of the things that triggered part of this article is that I was looking at a Princeton study that was talking about artificial intelligence and the way in which it learns biases. This is crazy stuff.
Wow.
So just by taking our language, the way we type it in, you know, in the way we, you know, whoever the bots are, you know, listening to us, you know that we're being, you know, monitored all the time through, you know, digital media and platforms and stuff. Artificial intelligence actually takes that and learns biases and our correlations, right? And then what happens is that, you know, we're going to rely on AI to, you know, for a lot more and more. And what happens when AI has these learned biases, and then we start creating educational programs and policies and studies and this, that, and the other thing. And these language biases, where women are in the home, they're not at their jobs. Women are taking care of children. They're not getting educated. By the way, these biases relate to race as well. And those are brutal. If you want to, there's an, I think it's called a, IATS study at Harvard. There's a study that comes out of Harvard and one that comes out of Princeton that sort of dovetail together to explain this. And it's terrifying. You know, so white men are in, you know, power and career and job, and you have, you know, African Americans who are biased against, you know, crime would be attached to their, you know, to African Americans, which is just wrong. And if you're thinking AI is taking cues from the way in which this language is used, we're in trouble. And that's what sort of made me go, oh, this is really important. We really have to watch the way we talk about this stuff. Family should
be men and women. That just blows my mind because, you know, I've been, I'm a complete Trekkie. I'm just going to, you know, be transparent right now.
Yeah.
And I have watched every single episode.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then again,
no,
and again.
I mean, awesome stuff. Yeah, it's great.
You know, engage, as Jean-Luc Picard would say, make it so. But, you know, what's really fascinating was I think Gene Roddenberry was absolutely brilliant. Every one of the episodes had a lesson in it. But one of the main characters throughout all was Mr. Data. And this was with the Patrick Stewart series, part of the Star Trek, The Next
right.
Generation. Mr. Data obviously was AI. I mean, he was an android. And,
right.
What was fascinating, if you look at some of the episodes, as he begins to evolve, he's picking up some of this stuff. And, right, you know, I mean, he's absorbing what's around him. Roddenberry got it early, way early before
anyone was
playing with it.
Yep.
Brilliant. Just absolutely brilliant. And then, then, you know, our pal, Mr. Data would have to sit back and learn from his mentors like, Captain Picard and all the rest of it. If something was becoming a bit errant, if he was picking up a bias from another alien, whomever, who was maybe discriminatory, really fascinating stuff. That's why I love this. Now, listen, you wrote this incredible book, The End of Men, which, by the way, I loved. And I'm not just saying that because I'm just saying. But so my question is, how does the New York Times piece on motherhood connect to your novel, The End of Men, which, of course, became the movie Maggie's Plan? There's a tie in here. I'm smelling it.
Yeah, you know, not intentional in a way, but of course, it's like, you know, I've got the subject that runs around in my head, which is, you know, mostly about, you know, the what women are allowed and versus what men are allowed. And again, this isn't just, you know, I'm surrounded by awesome men, so I feel like, you know, I've got a great husband and great father and great sons and nephews and friends. So it's not, this isn't an issue of taking issue with a, you know, the men in my life. It's just saying women have less bandwidth, you know, to travel through, right? Now, I always say men have a 4-lane highway, we've got a tightrope. And that's how, that's the way I see it. So what I wanted to do in the novel is I wanted to create women, 4 women, who had their own agency, who were self-determined, who were fierce, and not driven by, they weren't neurotic and they weren't victims and they weren't all the things that women often get pushed into as characters, one-dimensional, two-dimensional. They weren't there only to serve their male boss or their husband or looking for a boyfriend or a lover. You know, they were basically had their own agency. It's basically saying, okay, so these are women who have men in their lives and children, and they, you know, they have a lot in their lives. Now what? What do the problems look like when you have these things in your life and they have agency? And by the way, they don't, you know, some of their behaviors could be considered morally questionable. And I wanted to do that as well, to say, okay, let's test these female characters and see if people will give them some leeway, because we give male characters leeway all the time. And we, you know, this is, you know, in fiction and features and TV and, you know, the way we tell stories, I think we give men leeway and we find them charismatic and charming, even if they are, you know, morally corrupt. Women don't really get that. We don't really get forgiven on it. I wrote a piece for Time magazine called, you know, I call it Good Guys versus Bitches. And it's basically saying we have this you know, thing we say about guys, you know, well, he did this or that or the other thing, which wasn't great, but he's basically a good guy, right? I mean, he's a good guy. I say it all the time.
He's a good guy.
You know what? We have never heard, she's basically a good woman. If she messes up, whoever she is, let's call it me, I'm a bitch. Ah, she's a bitch. She's basically a bitch. So good guys versus bitches, same thing. We're judged. He's not.
Wow.
At least not as much. So I wanted to create a novel that sort of went through and said, all right, men are going to be secondary characters, so they're not going to be the primary characters. What happens when you do that, by the way? That made people uncomfortable because it was all women, driven by women and their desires and their needs and their positions and their places as mothers, because they are mothers. And men sort of went to the background. And some people have read it and said, you know, I feel sorry for the men. Well, why? Because they're not up front and center? We're so used to having them up front and center that when you put women up front and center, people aren't comfortable. So I'm just challenging that convention. And I do, so it's the same thing in you know, motherhood is sacrifice, you know, is it sacrifice or privilege? And I'm challenging the conventions of language, of character, of story, to say, let's just think about this, because we're all, and so it's not the end of men, also a provocation, but my point is, the end of men, meaning just join us on the ground. Join, you know, every women, you know, black, white, everything in between, LGBT, you know, we're all struggling down here. Hey guys, just join us. Come on, join the party here. So it's not the end of men, it's the end of men, you know, and that basically the assumption that is what's going to rule. And it's clearly not, but we're, you know, I think we all have to talk about it and be brave. And by the way, men who are not afraid of these conversations agree. I mean, like, it's funny, I get as much support from men as I do from women. In fact, sometimes more. Right, who go, yeah, you know, call it, sister, because they're, you know, they're, you know, they like, you know, yeah. Men who are strong like strong women. They like fierce women, women who are self-determined, because it makes everything work better. So I don't feel like.
So basically, your book is establishing, you know, you're quite the rebel. We're loving that.
I don't
Rinaldi,
know, maybe
the rebel.
I don't know if I am. I don't think I am. But that's okay. You can call me that.
I don't know. It sounds good. I mean, there's a little alliteration going on there too. Rinaldi the Rebel. But, you know, what you're also trying to do is have us all reframe this. We're reframing it with the vernacular. We're reframing it with our own perceptions. And we're trying to establish a new normal here so that when someone does read a novel like The End of Men, they won't go, wow, I feel a little uncomfortable because a guy wasn't, you know, first up on this. It was more about women and as the central characters here, just like in the movie Maggie's Plan. Mm-hmm. It was the women rocked it totally. And by the way, congratulations on... you know, your novel, your very first one, good Lord, talk about a home run, becoming, you know, a real hit with Hollywood. I saw the reviews and they were excellent. And
yeah, well, that's
rock
Rebecca
on.
Miller, who the remarkable Rebecca Miller, who was the director, screenwriter, producer. I mean, she just killed it. She's amazing.
Yeah. And what a lineup too. Good Lord.
And everybody, every role was, you know, perfectly cast, and they did such a good job, and it was a joy.
No, it was killer.
To see it come together.
I absolutely loved it. All right, well, everyone out there in her podcast land, we have had the honor and the privilege. Oh, there's that word again. The privilege of having Karen Rinaldi on with us today to talk about motherhood as a privilege, not a sacrifice. She's the author of the bestseller, The End of Men, which became the Hollywood movie, Maggie's Plan. And you can learn more about her at krinaldi.com. And at the same time, please run on out and get that damn book. It is so good. It's a summer, right? It's fall. I don't care what season it is. It's time to read this
still
book.
Still summer.
That's
still
all I can
summer.
Say.
We got a few days left.
I'm just saying, you know. Karen,
thank
you so much for being on her.
Thanks
really,
for
really
having me.
It.
It's a pleasure. Always fun to talk to you.
And everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And just take a second or two and rate and review us on iTunes because I read these. That's right. I have the time to read these. I want to hear from you. I'd love your feedback. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you could also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.